Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by the incredible Rad Roller Mobility Tools, my absolute favorite tools for self-myofascial relief for at-home treatment for all aches, pains, and mobility issues. They're an incredible asset to your movement program and care that you're already receiving. Check out the link in our show notes below to get $5 off your purchase of $25 or more. Enjoy today's episode.
Hey everyone, Dr. Carly here. Welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. And before we air today's recording, I want to let you know that this will be our last podcast for a while. I have been recording weekly and sometimes bi-weekly podcasts for the last 3 years in a passion project to help me educate more people about health and wellness and how we should invest in our bodies. This project has been incredible for me to get to meet such an amazing array of healthcare providers, healers, authors, expansive thinkers, and have in-depth conversations about the kind of things that just light me up: health, wellness, and improvement, personal improvement. At this time, my life with my 5.5-year-old and my private practice and all the things that I have going on, it's time for me to take a step back from the podcast. It was a very hard decision, and I am not ready to say it's over, just to say it's over for right now. I am currently wrapping up. Some of my listeners, you've heard me mention my book, my memoir, that is in its final editing phases or near final editing phases to come to you. And there will always be more education and outreach through Healing Ground Movement and Healing Ground Chiropractic to make sure that you don't miss out on any important updates and forthcoming announcements. Make sure, if you haven't already, that you visit the healinggroundmovement.com, the website, and sign up for our newsletter. Any and all updates, blogs, and education that I have forthcoming will be coming from that newsletter, and I don't want to lose touch with any of you. Thank you so much for joining me on this 3-year journey.
Our interview with Andrew Rosenstock is a phenomenal way to end this conversation for now, as we take a 30,000-foot view of what healing, curiosity, creativity, and opportunity have to do with our everyday choices and interactions. As always, be well, and I look forward to talking to you all again soon.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to joining us, a conversation in process. I am Dr. Carly Hudson, Healing Ground Movement podcast. And with us today, we have Andrew. And Andrew, I didn't ask how to pronounce your last name, Rosenstock. Yes.
Yeah. I was going to have you say, how do you think you say it? And you did it perfect. Good job.
Cool. I put a few more vowels in my head as I was remembering, catching myself in trouble. But I am so excited to have Andrew join us. This is, you know, of my favorite types of conversations are the ones where I get to do these discovery calls before we hop on to record the full podcast for our listeners. And Andrew and I had our call a few months ago and just kept talking. I love the way that he thinks about body movement, the stories that we have lived and the impacts on our lives. Andrew comes as a certified Rolfer, board certified structural integrator, certified 1,000-hour yoga therapist, iREST Yoga Nidre level 2 trained teacher, and holds multiple certifications in Thai massage, Esalen massage, and is a reconnection certified practitioner.
A lot of words.
a lot of credentials. But the takeaway is this man knows a thing or two about how we live in our bodies and how our bodies live and support us. So I am so excited to have Andrew join us today. And we'll just see where the conversation takes us. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. I'll add on to that. I'm just finishing up my biodynamic cranial sacral training, which is, I'm not certified yet, but in the process. And finishing up, hopefully, my Rolf movement certification. So I will have even more letters to make myself feel important.
Until you have a full paragraph of letters after your name, are you really achieving anything?
Exactly. Because those letters are really important.
Yeah, those are the things that make all the difference. As my doctor, totally. PhD letters, I should have done a Psi D something.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so Andrew, I was going to ask you, you know, I warned you before, I was going to ask you how you came to start doing this work. But really, the other question that comes to mind is, what is the thread that draws all of these certifications together for you?
Yeah, I like that actually, the second one more, because I think sort of looking at the what brought me here is, I mean, in some way that'll get, it could get very, very deep, and well, as you said, we can talk and we'll get off. So I think as far as the thread, I'll kind of put the two together in a way, and we'll see how that sort of rolls. But I did my first yoga training partly because I was just curious about yoga and I wanted to feel better in my body. And that opened up a door towards, well, becoming aware that there were things I wasn't aware of, or I had like a fuzziness, like, yeah, I realize I feel better after yoga would imply that I didn't feel great before yoga, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a little reductionist philosophy, but there it is. It's like, oh, so there starts to have a recognition that something could be different. And bless you. There you go. I was muted, so no one heard it, but I saw it. So I think the thread going along with that was, with all these sort of things, is a sense of how to understand, for lack of a better word, I'd say the human condition. What does it mean to be living in a body, existing in a mind, going through the world? And actually, you know, as the way sort of goes, I studied something with my first yoga training. I never wanted to be a yoga teacher. I only became a yoga teacher after being certified because I ended up living in Mongolia for a little bit and they wanted a yoga teacher. And I was like, all right. I studied Thai massage because I didn't want to be a massage therapist. I just wanted to learn more about the body so I could be a better yoga teacher. Then I became that. And then I started studying craniosacral because I heard about it in three strange coincidences. And I said, well, I don't know, why not? So everything kind of was an unintentional from my view of things, but they all kind of fit together in a way. And they all were relating to the partly the existential question of what is it to be a human being, again, similar, like in a physical body existing in the plane of thought and reality around us. So I think that's the sort of silver thread for me.
I love that. It reminds me a lot of where I kind of came through in all of my training. And this idea of wanting to know more and finding these layers upon layers of the web of the body. You know, I think we can get really reductionist in some of our traditional medical training is, you know, even within the physical body, this cardiovascular is different than digestion is different than respiratory and breathing. Mm-hmm. When you can just flip the lens of 180 degrees and see how one leads to another. And the more you start asking questions, I mean, you accidentally end up with 100 certifications after your name.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly with that. You know, one other thing I don't always talk about in my bio is that before I fell into this, I was a network engineer. I worked in computers and systems design. And that view of thinking, I think, comes really in handy because you start to, like you said, well, we have a cardiac system, which is both a part of its own system while it's also functioning within other systems. And so we start to have multiple dimensions of things working together, both as singular units and as whole units. And so for me, my training in systems design, people would say, like, well, why would you do body work? That's a complete change. And I'd be like, no, it's actually, for me, it's really similar. It's just looking at what is working, what is not working, how could this work in a more efficient way, and not keeping it on a two-dimensional plane or a one-dimensional, but on a three or four, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. And that systems is what really brought me into this whole world of unraveling. I started off in family and interpersonal systems. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a therapist. So that's where I started my undergrad. And then you start to see just enough, just a hint of, well, that seems to have an impact on your body, how you feel and how you mm-hmm. were raised. Maybe they're correlated. So I went to massage therapy training, not to be a massage therapist, but to start to understand the body. And this whole thing starts rolling out from there. And you just use this little bit of language about seeing where the problem is in the system that I want to expand from, mm-hmm. because I think it can be really overwhelming for people who are coming to sort of this holistic view of healing from this idea of what I call symptom whack-a-mole. This is wrong. Fix the thing. Two-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Done. Versus once you crack open what sometimes feels like a Pandora's box for people, depending on where their health is at, it can be overwhelming and complicated. Be like, wait, the cardiovascular system is somehow related to my respiratory system, which is somehow related to my kidneys. What is happening here? You know, forget about the meat sack that everything is housed inside. How does that systems idea that you bring with you sort of tease it apart?
Well, I'm going to answer that, but I'm going to correct one of the words I might have used, because I think semantics become pretty important, and I sometimes say the incorrect word while meaning something underneath, which is, if I did say, sort of looking at the problems, is that there actually isn't really a problem. There's just things happening. There's just phenomena happening that may not be as beneficial as they could be, but they're not problems, because I take I studied a fair amount of sort of Buddhist psychology, which you start to look at the nature of things in our minds within that. And one of the things is that there really is no good or bad. Mm-hmm. Like there's just things. There's just what is, exactly. And so that when there is that, there isn't really a problem, but there are things that could be maybe more efficient, more helpful, more this, more that, but they're not good or bad. They're just as they are. So I just want to correct that. It's not necessarily a problem. And then I'll revert back to your question, which you're going to repeat for me because I get lost in my own thoughts sometimes.
I think this is how we end up having such great winding conversations. We both get lost because I am going to trouble. I love that language of phenomena happening. Mm-hmm. Something is happening. And when we can get like really didactic about semantics, which is my first love, is it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. Something mm-hmm. phenomenal is happening. Do we maybe want to change it? Do we want to enhance it? So when we start to look at this phenomena, when we start to look at what is, and maybe what is not supportive of the daily lifestyle that you want to have. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is supportive and you want to enhance it more. You know, when we have that 2D image of, I want to improve or get rid of this one thing, that feels really simple. But mm-hmm. once we start, if we're new to this way of thinking, once we start putting all of these layers together, how does one dive into this different way of thinking without getting immediately overwhelmed?
Well, first of all, I don't know if overwhelm is a bad thing. I don't know if overwhelm is a bad thing, because again, there's no good or bad, but that overwhelm sometimes can be helpful. I think it becomes the level of overwhelm, or maybe it's just whelm. So how does someone become whelmed?
That's a good throwback.
Whelm. Yeah. I think part of it is for me, where I am right now is the way of meeting as I'm hearing your question, it's like, if someone was coming to me and I didn't want them to get overwhelmed, how mm-hmm. would I meet them there? I would meet them from a place of first being comfortable, safe, not overwhelmed, supported in myself, and whatever, I almost said a bad word, whatever SH-T I had going on in my life. I'm from Boston. We swear, deal with it. Whatever stuff I had going on with my life that was taking me overwhelmed, I would in some way not deny it, sort of push it on the side and say, listen, I'm going to come back to you. Right now I have another role, of which is this. And so I'm not denying it. I'm not saying I can't deal with them. I'm saying, okay, we're going to come back. And right now I need to be present, or I need to be in this place so that this person here doesn't get overwhelmed. Because, you know, right now, if I start talking like this and you're going in here and all that, and we're having this conversation, and like, you're like, whoa, like people listening right now are going to jump back for a second, right? Because I'm not in a place of providing enough safety within myself. So your nervous system is already going to be on guard. So I think the first thing is to get into a place of where can the practitioner or the person be in a place of calm, supportive, the ventral vagal dura, actually not ventral vagal, sorry, more parasympathetic way of being, although a little bit of ventral vagal, and saying, okay, I'm in this place and I can hear you and I can see you. And when you do get, if you do get overwhelmed, I can also meet that and not be like, well, why are you getting overwhelmed? Don't get overwhelmed. It's real, you know? And so first part is that the later part starts to get into, I think part of it partly becomes semantics and partly becomes how do we, not necessarily just semantics, but how do I express something? So part of it is, I think, semantics in terms of how do we meet the person where they are. And I think there's a, I don't know if we talked about this last time, there's a type of therapy work called focusing, which a guy named Eugene Genlin developed. And he's one of the first people who talked about felt sense. And he has a line I really always remembered. He said, when you don't hear what I'm saying, you hear what you hear me saying. And so the more that we can continue to refine that you're hearing more of what I am intending to say, right? Getting into that language, it becomes more helpful. I will say that most of the clients I work with around generally the first session, they do leave a little confused because it is so different for them. And then around second, third, or maybe fourth, they if I can get them to stay, they say, now I get what you're saying. Now I get it. Okay. Because how do you understand something you have no understanding of? You can't. And we spin around a circle of trying to understand, which we can't because it's literally not in our wheelhouse of knowledge. So I try to pepper it in that if you're confused, that's a great place to be. Mm-hmm. That growth comes from discomfort and being confused can be uncomfortable. It doesn't mean you're wrong. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. No one's right or wrong. We're just in this place. And like other people have been there and they've grown. And so maybe that also might be helpful for you without telling them as well that like this will happen, because that also doesn't enable them to make choices and grow themselves. It just keeps them in a sheep role, which a lot of people like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then certainly it's a place that many people and many cultural norms have trained us into. Mm-hmm. But what I like that you bring back to is that the practitioner begins the container, begins mm-hmm. that relationship. And I think it's something that, and I'm going to kind of catch myself on that beginning because of course the client is coming in. I'm trying to get to say is that the relationship and the work actually doesn't start with the application of a protocol mm-hmm. or a nutraceutical or a type of massage or a type of energy work or body work or what have mm-hmm. you. It begins with the meeting of these people in a room, practitioner, client, clients, practitioners, and that container that is being held mm-hmm. and that place of understanding. And we see this in sort of anecdotal evidence that I know we've talked about on the podcast before, that it matters far less the type of work that you receive and more the relationship with the person mm-hmm. who is providing it, mm-hmm. where there is more success in therapy and body work for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember early on when I was a very young yoga teacher, I was teaching, and one of my teachers had taught people and they said, we actually prefer you. And I remember thinking, no, you're wrong. My teacher knows so much more than me. And mm-hmm. I don't know anything. But my teacher had such poor personal skills. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't his fault. He came from a culture where they're more known for being cold. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he expressed in the world. And for some people that would work well. And for these people, it didn't. And my lack of knowledge was less important than the fact that they felt seen, they felt heard, they felt comfortable. And that mm-hmm. it was a place where they could grow from instead of coming in being already on guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then that offers up to this idea where it is not a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm going to endeavor to be very careful with my language because I do love that principle of there is only what is, mm-hmm. we don't have to assign negative or positive value I'm sure I will make mistakes, but I will try.
I do it every day. I do it every day. And this is what I've been practicing for a while. It's the practice. It's just the practice and seeing it. Yeah.
And so now what was my train of thought about? So that when you come in and you start talking about it, it is not a bad thing to be overwhelmed or perhaps just whelmed. If anyone knows the movie reference, please do reach out.
I what's that reference?
That's the reference? Oh, okay. I'll do it. It's 10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh, okay. It's been a while. Oh, okay. Yes, yes. Yeah. I think Julia Stiles.
Yeah. There's this ponderous thought of, I know you could be overwhelmed. I know you could be underwhelmed, but can you ever just be whelmed? I think it was Kerry Washington back in her finest teenage role. So this idea, back to body work, that when we have that place of entering into a new way of learning and a new way of being, it is overwhelming. There is confusion. And I think that has been pushed towards this edge of being considered bad or being too much. But I have sat with patients who have, you know, endeavored to learn something new through that confusion of, we're going to understand what's happening in your body through a whole new way. Mm-hmm. And it's gone really well. And I've sat with other patients or even patients in my own office where I'm not speaking the same language or the same tone as them, where it goes really, really poorly. Mm-hmm. And that learning edge through confusion is the gift of healing, kind of opening up before you. Mm-hmm. And you have someone that you are comfortable with where there isn't defensiveness, where there is an opportunity to say, I don't know, and I'd like to know more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded sort of, I was just in Ireland. And I had a client who was a psychotherapist. So coming in, and what I actually did say is, like, whatever you knew before, like, please try not to bring it. Of course, that's impossible, but like, really try not to, because you're going to be tracking me through your lens. But like, this is different, and it's it was an hour of fighting each other essentially, because I was attempting to meet her. But she was trying to lead. She had ideas of this. It was hilarious in a way. And I knew I couldn't give her. I knew that if I just gave her what she thought she wanted, it wasn't actually what I believed was needed. Mm-hmm. And yet there was this confusion. There was a struggle. And I made the choice that I was going to do what I believed was best, because that people come to me for what I believe. And after an hour, there was a switch. And she got it. So the first hour was so confusing and so difficult. I was even telling myself, all right, she's not going to come back and she's going to probably complain to the owner. And I'm going to have to complain to the owner. Listen, I did what you hired me for. But there was a switch where that confusion, where all of a sudden it opened up. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly uncomfortable, because in order for that to open up, there had to be a letting down of some structure that was keeping her in a perception of safety, but that perception of safety was limiting anything else, right? I use the metaphor that walls don't just keep people from getting in, they keep people from getting out, right? Mm-hmm. And as the wall slowly came down, it didn't get knocked down. I wasn't fighting her, but I was like meeting with a sort of a little bit of resistance. Then the wall slowly came down, and then she let the wall come down more, because she slowly was able to all of a sudden have the confusion shifted to a more of an awareness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. And I've sat in that conversation before, and I really admire you for just holding that space, because we do, I think, as practitioners have to have this internal dialogue of, how much can I piss this person off?
Yeah. Yeah. I think of it slightly different words, but yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I did my time in Boston, but I'm a Denver girl originally. So I'm going to stick with some different, slightly different language. Because there is that resistance of inviting someone to a new way of looking at healing. Mm-hmm. And that does involve a letting go of what we thought we knew. And sometimes mm-hmm. that is an easier or harder journey. And, you know, many times there is a kill the messenger mm-hmm. component to that, mm-hmm. where the practitioner on the other side knows, like, if this goes poorly, I'm the one sitting in the hot seat. I'm the one that's yep. going to come back around to.
Yeah, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, we've enjoyed our conversations, and we may have talked about this last time, so I apologize, but you know, I had a friend visiting from out of town, and he was here yesterday. We're going for a walk today, and I was sharing with him that I really enjoy being wrong or incorrect. Yeah. Right? Because I enjoy, because being right doesn't actually serve me except for making my ego feel as exactly as it is. And so it makes me feel good because I know things to be, whoop-de-doo. But when I'm incorrect, when I'm slightly off and somebody corrects me, that allows me to have new knowledge and have new growth, right? And what my friend told me is that's wonderful. I don't think most people want to do that. Yeah. and I feel like your problem the same. And this is, but I also know with me is that if right now you gave me information, what I generally do is I will say, thank you. And I'll put a wall up and I'll put a wall, slight wall up. And then tomorrow I will, after I've digested it a bit, I'll say, oh, actually, yeah, I see what you're saying. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and so my old pattern was just to say no. And it's, you know, it fades into being like, okay, maybe, and then sitting with it and then digesting and then having time to say, wait a minute, because what you're essentially doing is saying, hey, like you've been looking for that lost earring, but you've been looking at the ceiling. Have you ever tried looking at the ground?
What do you mean the ground?
Yeah. What ground? What is, you know, and if you're looking at the ceiling, that's all you know. Yeah. So, yeah.
No, I'm completely, my patients will hear me say a lot is like, I'd love to be wrong. Mm-hmm. I say it a lot when I send them from imaging too. It's like, you know, I don't want to be right about this, but let's be sure. It's nice to be wrong. You get to learn in that wrongness. And what I'm really enjoying about this conversation, because again, we didn't really have a set plan for where this was going, is that this is in its own way an allegory for growth, and growth is healing. At least it's transition and change, because again, as we start to look at taking away these presumptive value words out, you know, healing is good, illness is bad, so to say. So maybe we set those aside and we talk about growth, and we can either be in survival mode, which is neither good nor bad. We need to survive. This is good. Sometimes it's more stressful than we want it to be for, I don't know, say a 2-year period.
Or longer.
Or we can be in growth, but our body can't do both at the same time. But when we have this expansive thinking, like Andrew and I are talking about here today, where we can be wrong and pick up a thread to move further, move past presumptions by way of curiosity, that is the hallmark of growth. Mm-hmm. Growth is where we get to experience healing for what it is.
So I want to say something just about that, which is, and we'll go into that growth, but this is something I try to educate and share with my clients, that if being wrong leads to growth, then it's not wrong, that it's right. Right. And so it's this interesting way of looking at it. It gets to a different paradigm of thinking. And I use the metaphor of a child walking, is they have to fall. And falling is wrong, except that falling is the right thing to do in order to learn. That learning is essentially about having the wrong steps, but if they're the wrong steps to get there, they're not the wrong steps. So it's only in that perspective of looking at it as it's wrong. Mm-hmm. In the wider view, it's actually perfectly right. And it ties in. There actually isn't, if there's no good and there's no bad, there just is, there's no wrong or no right. There just is as it is. Now, is it the most beneficial way of doing it? Did you fall 20 times when you could have only fallen 5 times? Sure. Mm-hmm. However, you fell 20 times. Now what?
Yeah.
Where are we now? Yeah.
And I think about it with that attachment to the way of doing things. If you think about if your health is not in a place where you find it to be the most functional and supportive for what you want, for where you're going in the world. And I've had this conversation before with patients where I say, like, I've been doing all the right things and I still feel this terrible. Mm-hmm. And it makes me, and I might try next time to say, well, then don't you hope that you're doing all the wrong things? And it's, you know, what this attachment for right and wrong is in this moment may not be. Because these right things are bringing you to a new opportunity that might show you that they are the wrong thing. So now you're going to do the wrong thing to get the right response.
Yeah.
Confusing.
Yeah. And definitely, like, don't tell this to your clients, but I would say, like, who's right?
Yeah.
It's not your right. It's what you've been told is right. And therefore it's your mental construct. And we'll get away from this because it'll get more into less, in some way, less into body, although it's there's a body's response. It's a mental construct of what we've taken things to be. And so we're following onto a path of what we've been either presumed, have been told, or thought life is. And this is actually why, as a child, I suffered severe depression, is that life didn't match up with how I thought, how I was told, how I conceived life to be. And so it was very confusing. And I was severe depression, anxiety, all that stuff. Luckily, I had good help and support and later on tools to realize that, like, any thought I have is just that. It's a thought. Life is showing up. We didn't have a plan for what we had a middle plan for what we'd get to in this talk, and we may not get to that. And yet we're getting into this other rich information. And so when we get out of our way of what's the doing the right things, I mean, it's not as easy as that, of course. But it's, you know, getting out of the way, then we, it's a practice. Yeah. And then that'll lead us into growth, which I know you wanted to talk about. I'm not sure how.
Well, at this point, I don't even remember where I started with proposing that question. I think we were sort of tiptoeing around this idea of that we can be in survival or we can be in growth, and growth in itself is sort of that healing. And none of these things are either good nor bad unless we are staying in one at the detriment of the other. Then it's a matter of functionality.
So, right. It's also a matter of perspective. I mean, so for when I talk with my clients about working with the capital T word, the trauma, when they're stuck with stuff, right? we spoke about that before, and maybe we'll dive into that. What I usually say is a lot of it is our bodies, all human beings are always organizing to safety. We're doing everything to keep ourselves safe, right? Except it's not actually safety, it's perception of safety, which sounds very similar, but can be worlds apart, right? And so how are we perceiving it, whatever is interacting with ourselves and also interacting with the world around us, right? So if I'm looking at you right now and there's something in the background that it has a resonance of something that at one point I didn't feel safe, like a babysitter that had this something, and I was like, oh, that bookshelf reminds me of this. And I could possibly go into a place of, well, this conversation isn't safe. But it's not that the conversation isn't safe, it's that there's something in my perception that is leading it to be. And that perception may be true fully, or it may be just a partial truth or my own subjective truth. And so that aspect of perception becomes really important towards growth, is how much are we perceiving what is to be what is, and how much is not exactly.
Yeah. And so with that, we did talk about before, and I wanted to circle back to it today. You know, you brought up the big T trauma. You know, there's little T traumas, but you had a different way that you'd like to talk about trauma and working through this, you know, these histories that are stored in the body. Can you share that with us a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say the histories are as best as I know, are may be stored in the body, may be stored in mind, may be stored in both, and may be stored in other. And I know it's annoying that I don't give as definitives. I'm not saying it is, because it's all super personal. And while I can see body and mind related stuff, I can't necessarily see, I'm not aware of any other theoretical, energetic, or other, but I don't deny that they are very well maybe. So that being said, I think some people are going to be like, what the hell is he talking about? And other people are going to be like, yeah, rad. But I know you like it, so that works for me.
Yeah.
So as we talked about before, what I sort of started to find was, first of all, I found that trauma, what I call capital T, like, is, and when I say capital T, I just mean that it's like, it became so buzzworthy. Everything was trauma, this trauma, that. And it became super, like, people were throwing it around, like, oh, I'm a trauma survivor. I've had trauma, this or that, which isn't necessarily bad. Like, own it, if for sure. But also, like, when it becomes the Gucci bag, when it becomes like you're rocking your Fendi trauma bag, it's like, what does that actually mean? And I also sort of found it didn't, you know, as we talked about before, it didn't give me anywhere to go, because it's just this thing. And because I have a lot more. I've become much more felt aware. So when I'm in my body, there are different images and different things that are happening before my brain says stuff and labels stuff. For me, when I would even say trauma, it felt like a Bugs Bunny type weight, like something Bugs would give to like Sylvester or something. I don't know, I remember like the Roadrunner, or and it would just drop it down. It was just like this heavy weight that, and that didn't allow me to move around it. And I was thinking, well, how can my clients move around it if they're just carrying this weight with them? Like, how do you let go of a weight if it's just carrying with you? And so I started to think about other ways. I started to think, well, what is trauma? And I said, well, okay, it's something that we've lived through. We've lived through this experience. And for one reason or another, we haven't fully processed it, right? And this is what I was also saying, where it's like, we can maybe process it from our mind. We can maybe process it from the body. It doesn't mean that we necessarily process it from both or from one or the other. And so I started to look at rearranging it, because when I saw that it was an unprocessed lived experience, it also implied the fact that it could be processed. Mm-hmm. And for me and my body, when I would say trauma, my body would stop. But when I would say unprocessed lived experience, which is a lot more words, there was a lightness. My ribs were more open. And I thought, well, if this is it for me, maybe for my clients it would be. And I start to find as they change the labeling of their description of it, which is also the description of them and how they live in the world, it allowed for more growth. It was literally like their body would smile. And it's also, it's like a doorway opens up, because mm-hmm. all of a sudden you say, well, yeah, I could process this, you know, and mm-hmm. it's just the semantical aspect of unprocessed implies processing. Right. Yeah. But there is no non-trauma. There's no word there. You say, oh yeah, he's got non-trauma. There's just like life and trauma, you know?
Well, yeah. And I'm glad that we even started this conversation way back with making sure semantics became important, because in this place, we really do see that when we give an opportunity for change, when I'm kicking myself, like, okay, what part of speech is unprocessed? but to unnoun it, to not just have this singular, unmoving weight, this thing, this trauma. I have trauma. And what I hope our listeners are hearing in this is that it's not that either Andrew or I are denying the weight and the heaviness of mm-hmm. having a lived experience that was in itself traumatic. Mm-hmm. Taking a step back from that word to the semantics of what that word is. And that is an unprocessed lived experience. When you get into definitions of trauma on that somatic and even therapeutic processing, it is something that your body, your mind, your spirit, whatever, wherever we're keeping this, whatever field we're using, mm-hmm. was unable to complete.
Mm-hmm. And and the other thing I didn't say mm-hmm. this time is that the trauma doesn't tell you the magnitude of it. Mm-hmm. So like being in the genocide and falling down, like tripping up the stairs, are both traumas, one a smaller, one larger, mm-hmm. although each of them is measured within your own experience. So it's also like, the word trauma doesn't even really tell you much about what the experience is. And mm-hmm. so how do you grow? You're fully right. I'm not denying that trauma happens. What I'm trying to say is, okay, like, that's horrible. All traumas are horrible in a way. And how do if we want to grow from there, we have to actually see, well, what are these things? And as a way of growing, if we want to grow there, and some don't, and that's fine as well, because it can be a lot and it can shut us down. And like, I'm by no means am I pooping on people with trauma. I'm trying to just offer ways to have different perspectives.
Right. Yeah. And it is a lot of work to grow through a lot, some mm-hmm. of these things, mm-hmm. many, all. But what I like about the point you make is that it is not enough, but for some people it is enough. Mm-hmm. It is not perhaps the complete story. It is not the full experience of what one can do with an unprocessed lived experience to name it. Naming it is a start. Naming it gives it shape, gives it weight to you. But mm-hmm. like you're talking about letting it become the Fendi bag of that thing, that thing you found. You know, look at this cool thing I found. Not cool thing. Look at this thing I found in my closet. The skeletons in my closet. I'm just going to carry it with me, because we're all talking about our traumas right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That in itself can be an incomplete process. Mm-hmm. but with full recognition that you can only process what you're ready to process.
For sure, for sure. Or in what you're aware of. And mm-hmm. one way to help get more aware of things is to also see things from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's what I sort of found, was that it allowed some people to see it from a different perspective, to not just to see it, but to feel it, mm-hmm. to actually have. Because what I would sometimes do with people is say, okay, so like, say you have trauma, and then say you have an unprocessed lived experience. And they would say both of them either out loud or in personal, inside. And then I would ask them, do they feel different to you? And most people, not everyone, but most people would say, yeah, there's a different feeling tone to it. The essence of it is different. And this, we're not going to have time for this today, but this is where, like, since I've last talked to you, I've sort of gotten much more into semantics and looking at semantics mixed with phenomenology, mixed with a few other things, and start to recognize the expression of a human being, how their words don't always resonate with what the body is saying. Mm-hmm. But that'll be for another time. That'll be for another time, because we'll just go off. But the point being that, like, they're expressing and starting to notice, yes, there's a difference, and that allows them to then have a new perspective, because they're recognizing just the difference in feeling is a new point here. It's a new direction for them to move around it.
And that change gives you a way out or a way through. Because mm-hmm. was it Einstein that says is insanity to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different response? So having that new perspective and that new curiosity is a new way of being in it. Mm-hmm. And I would love if you would expand a little bit more on that felt sense. You know, so many of us live entirely in our mind. You know, when was the last time we even slowed down to know, this is what my heartbeat feels like, this is my gut feeling because something is happy, because something is scary? Dropping into that felt sense can be a really foreign experience for a lot of people. So can you bring a little bit more texture to the conversation you were having about, do those words feel different to you?
Yeah, I mean, I can try. I mean, the thing I'll say is, the description of a feeling is not a feeling, which becomes super complicated, because it's, as soon as we describe a feeling, we are no longer in the feeling, we're in the thought of the feeling. And some people, like, I've been working with my dad to try to help him in ways, and I love my dad. I was like, almost no one we always want to help more than our family. And my dad struggles with this, so I'll try with, I think you'll get it, but I'll still try, is that there is places before thought. That's essentially what meditation is. And not mindfulness, because mindfulness is a thought to get there. We're trying to do something to get to this place. But there is a place before thought, or after thought, or between thought. They're all the same, because if you think of thoughts like ants in a line, right, going out, in between each ant, there's a microscopic space before the next thought starts. And so within that, if we can get out of our head, which is very difficult if we live in our head, because we're going to be using our head to get out of the head, becomes a dog chasing its tail. What I will say is to those listening, believe the possibility that it may be a place. It may not be, but just think, what if it was? That when we're not in our thought, then we're in something else. And what are we as a human being? Well, we know we're a mind, we know we're a body. If we're not in our thought, we could be more in our body. Our body is actually what is living in the world. You are sitting in a chair, I'm guessing. Your mind is not saying, your mind is constructing your body partly how to sit, to work with gravity, to work with the construction, and your body is just kind of doing the thing. But your body is what is connecting with the world. So the felt sensing is sort of what happens in that place before the thought, or even during the thought, but we have harder times to see it. I can go a little bit more into the phenomenology of it as I take it to be, but I think that I'll lose some people. and B, it might be more if we have another talk at some point about semantics and looking at it. But I'll say that there is, you know, if we all sat for a second and just took a breath and did our best not to be in our minds, which some of us are going to still be in our mind, and that's fine. we might notice, like, well, what I'd say is as you're sitting there, you might notice that your butt is on the chair in certain ways. And you might actually notice, like, oh, there's more sensation on my left side than my right side. There starts to be a sense of texture, of pressure, of something. There might be a tinglingness. You're going to have sensations going on that most of the time we're not aware of because we're living up here. Mm-hmm. And when we do quiet the mind a bit, we can start to come into that. Or if somebody points it, so if someone says, like, hey, when I said this, and or when I had you say this and I had you say this, is there a difference? The person doesn't know what they're looking for. They know there's a difference. That's all they're going to probably be at today. That's fine. The awareness of, like, of being unaware leads to new awareness. So there's an awareness that there's a feeling that's different, but you can't put your hands on it. Of course you can't. It's a feeling. But it's a door opening to, okay, well, there's something that may be there. It's relatively impossible to see with our mind because it's before the mind. Mm-hmm. However, we can see it with our body. And we start to use sensuality, I'll say that. And that word gets misconstrued with sexuality a lot. But when I say sensuality, I mean of the senses. So, you know, people say, well, I can only see with my, you know, with my eyes. And there's a quote from Dr. Ida Rolf, where she said, seeing is touch at a distance.
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard that one.
Isn't it? Oh, yeah. It's really lovely. Seeing is touch at a distance, which is similar why we can be in Zoom and be touching each other. We're interacting with each other, right? Mm-hmm. It is partly, like I said before, if we create a calm environment, the nervous system is going to intertwine around that. It starts to feel more safe. But there's other stuff that we can do. Your nervous system is seeing my nervous system. It's hearing my nervous system. It's feeling my nervous system, and vice versa. So that when we start to get into the world of senses before the mind, we have this whole wide world that we can be interacting with. From a body worker's standpoint, if I want to change the person's relation to the world, they have chronic pain. I want to get them out of chronic pain. Well, partly I got to see, well, how are they relating to the world? Is it just that their arm is stuck in this way? Well, why? Is it because they had an injury, or is it because they got really angry and held onto that for some reason and never realized they're holding? And so what of them is relating, and how can I help them feel different, see different, be different?
Well, and all of this really starts to come back to that systems conversation we were having at the beginning, is mm-hmm. that, you know, we can have, you could line up, you know, a dozen people with a stiff left shoulder, mm-hmm. and every single one of them would have a different entry point into their system of where that phenomena is happening, mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. it's happening and how it wants to change, mm-hmm. because of how they're experiencing the world. Mm-hmm. And that opportunity for change would be different in all of them based on the openness to a curiosity of observing that story, mm-hmm. that beginning mm-hmm. differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think of when I first started teaching yoga, it was like I was parroting my teachers. All emotions are held in the psoas. And then, you know, and I hear yoga teachers now saying, oh, the psoas is this. And I think, is it? Maybe. Sometimes. Mm-hmm. For that person, yes. For that person, no. And I end up upsetting in some way some clients where they come in and they say, well, what do you think it is? And I say, I don't know. Let's look, you know. Oh, my doctor said this. That's great. That's what your doctor said. Let's see what else it might be. Maybe it is that. Maybe it's not. And that non-definitive answer really upsets them because they want definitive, because also they want an answer. Yeah. Except the answer that they're told, like, might not be it. And for me, I would rather have no answer than a wrong answer or an incorrect answer. That's me. I'm different, I guess, you know?
Because yeah. we're going to create, just by human nature, and then that looking for safety, we're going to create attachment to that answer that we perceive as right, and can mm-hmm. spend a lot of time, you know, worshiping at that altar of correctness mm-hmm. instead of, you know, as I know you and I love to be wrong and go find the next opportunity for that change.
Yeah, we got to find a better word than wrong, because it's not the right thing, but we like to be less than accurate.
Corrected within our assumptions.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that that is a really wonderful place to be when looking at the curiosity of growth and healing, to be corrected within our assumptions, because there are so many places where, you know, the way we engage with life is, in a sense, an assumption of correctness, how I eat, how I move, how I work, the balance I bring to, balance being whatever word we want to get into semantics there, between work and play and family and all of these things. No one is going through life going, you know what, I'm going to really screw it up today. I'm just going to do everything as unfunctionally as I possibly can. You know, we enter into our day with this assumption of, well, this is what I see my community doing, and this is what my parents did. And so I think this is correct. Yet here I am with a phenomena of dysfunction, with a phenomena of I'm not comfortable in my own body. So what we're really asking for is having that assumption be corrected, to be wrong, and have the opportunity to learn.
And something must be wrong with me, because, you know, social media, the person over there doesn't have that. And so I must be wrong, right? And so I'm looking for more answers to prove how I could be right, instead of like, well, what about me? Like, you know, my wife and I will have disagreements sometimes, because we grew up in entirely different cultures. And sometimes we can actually talk about how cultures affect our bodies entirely. But, you know, she grew up in mainland China, where there's a group collective. And so you do what the group says largely, because that's what you're taught. And I grew up in America, where we're like, screw groups, I'm going to do it myself. Right. And actually the answer really is neither. Like, because you can't have a group without an individual, and you can't have an individual without a group, because if there's no other thing, there is no me. It's just, so yeah, this again, like you sort of said, it ends up, what is health but being in the ultra, I don't know the right word, the essential balance in that moment. And balance doesn't mean being 50-50. Balance might be like, well, we're 20-80 right now, and in a second we're going to be 30-70. That's a bit of what the, as I understand the osteopaths, when they talk about health, they're talking about that.
Yeah. Finding that space of homeostasis within our own body, our own individual, within community, our own community built out of individuality. You know, that's what we see play out in nature. It is not a stagnant line, but different populations will rise and fall to support other populations to rise and fall. And if we can work in that construct of being curious and unattached to, this works now, but it might not work tomorrow. You know, where does that let us take ourselves?
Yeah. Or it works now and it might not work in a minute.
It's like, oh, that's over. Knows that one.
For sure. See, I enjoy talking with you, because I, well, first of all, you just reify my own beliefs. So you make me feel better about myself.
I mean, our egos need it. So I'm here
totally.
For that. We talked about being wrong, but we got egos. We're here.
Yeah.
Andrew, I love chatting with you. I love having you on the podcast. I can't believe we have already chatted through an hour. But I think that this has created its own sort of container of looking at health from a very 30,000 foot view. You know, I've been doing this podcast for 3 years now.
Wow.
And it started off, And it started off as a conversation about different protocols of this is what you can do here. Have you heard about this type of therapy? You know, drink more water, eat these foods, let's do all of the things. And it's come to my attention over the years that if it were as simple as doing the thing, all you would have to do is have it show up on your Instagram feed, you'd pick it up and you'd walk away with it. And what is coming to mind over the last year and a half of doing this, the latter half of this podcast, is how do we think about health? How do we think about ourselves and our need to be right and our attachment to what we're doing and our openness to try something new? That at its heart the conversation that we've had here today, quite by accident and entirely on purpose, is that that is the direction that we find health, that we find well-being, and we find growth. Mm-hmm. And for some of us, that is going to take a very big focus shift of focus from what has been our cultural given for our whole lives, some of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I hear it, you had growth through the podcast.
Ah, indeed. I was so very wrong in the beginning, and I'm so happy to
do so. Yeah. And what we think right now very well also. I mean, this is one of the reasons why people tell me I should write a book sometimes. What I struggle with, and this is my own in ego, is that if whatever I thought 5 years ago was completely different than I think now, whatever I write now, in 5 years, will I look back on that and think, well, that's not even right. I don't want people to read that, you know, but that's more of just my ego. And some way I have to let it go. I hear what you're saying. And I think that it goes back to a little bit of earlier of how I think a bit of the there's a Taoist principle called Wu Wei, which is like effortless doing or the action of no action, of how to share these paradigms of thought with people without forcing it on them, right? Mm-hmm. How to have those clients who need to be met a little bit, but too much meeting, just like an extra drop of rice, one grain of rice becomes too much. And that straddling the line of like, where is the right, where is the balanced place? Because too much, my ego does come over, and I'm doing it from a place of ego versus a place of love and a place of heart. And not enough, and I'm not actually meeting them as best for them. And so it is a real fine line that I don't have an answer to. I succeed and I fail. I definitely fail at points where I do have too much ego. I generally don't have too little ego. I'm either right there where I am, or my ego takes over. but it's a fine line within that. But I think that as long as, to some extent, as long as we trust, it gets, so here's the issue, is it gets, just like I was saying, trauma as like a Fendi bag, trust the process. I'm on my journey. These have all become cliches that don't actually have the value under it. So I don't want to, and also at the same point, we can give up a sense of ourselves. We can disassociate where we say, well, I just trust the process. Mm-hmm. And then we're no longer actually involved in it. And so it's a hard line. I mean, if I had the answers, I'd be a millionaire. I don't have the answers, but I think part of the answers come from inquiry, of continuing to go back and forth and say, well, where am I in this? How am I in this? Which means that we're always doing work, which some people see as not, they just don't want to do it. And that's fine. But you and I think are going to be the kind of people who are going to keep saying, well, let's keep doing work and let's keep refining.
I agree. And I think that ultimately that's the inquiry that I'm inviting our listeners to as well. You know, we are all such individuals, and can we keep finding that inquiry and keep doing the work? I think that is where our conversation will come to a close for today.
Yeah, you know, I think so.
Run again. But Andrew, if people are so taken by this conversation, as I know I am, where can they find more of you?
Totally. I mean, the first thing I do want to say also is I talk a lot, but I also do use, I do like when people come in for Rolfing or other body work, like, yes, I can drop an elbow. I do move into the body. It's not strictly philosophical. There is a process. There is movement in the body. There is pressure. There is a lot of that deep body work. So don't be worried. There is that there too. It's all a part of it. I spent the last 12 years working all over the globe, and I've just moved back to Boston with my wife. So I'm slowly, people can find me on my website is andrewrosenstock.com, very clever. And I also have one that's rolfinginboston.com, which is going to be for my more of my local practice. And people can find me there. You can always email me. It's a very difficult email. It's my name, andrew@andrewrosenstock.com. Who would have thought that? They can email me if they have questions or you know, concerns. I've ended up probably, I would imagine, I don't know if it's similar with you. I ended up during COVID moving a lot online and surprisingly getting really good results through, clearly I can't touch people, but doing movement work, doing analysis and having people move in different ways to get rid of chronic pain and other stuff. So I do some of that as well. And then, you know, I'm in Europe a lot, but I'm more or less in Boston right now.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, definitely we'll put those links on how to find you and the correct spelling of your name, because that is the kingdom there in the show notes below. But Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. I so love this conversation and this very broad and sweeping view of that personal inquiry and continuing work of health and growth. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the space that you hold. And these sort of conversations, they're really not, and I don't know how people hear it, they're really not about us just speaking. We're both listening and learning. And I think that for me, I grow a lot with this. And so I'm just thankful for that. And I'm glad that people have you to listen to.
Thank you. And to all those listeners, those people who are listening, thank you for tuning in today. You know, I hope this helped you move a little closer to that edge of curiosity, of discomfort, quiet the ego for a moment and look for some alternative answers in your own journey. Take care, and we'll talk to you again soon. In the meantime,
peace.
Well. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it to help you on your journey to health. Please, if you're inclined, share this podcast with a friend so we can help more people lead healthier lives. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help. And we'll see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. Be well.